So I guess we have... We always have a variety of possible things to talk about. But I think I'll start with elaborating a little bit on the point that carried over from last time. The question of how is it that meditation leads to awakening, enlightenment, liberation? Because that does seem like a pretty important question. I mean, meditation has all kinds of other wonderful benefits, but considering that that is the ultimate prime purpose of it, it'd be nice to have some idea of just how the one leads to the other. That's on here. So, meditation prepares the mind so that certain kinds of experiences will arise that profoundly change the way a person perceives everything. Absolutely everything. And that's what, when we talk about awakening or enlightenment, what are we talking about? We're talking about the result of the human mind being transformed in such a way that it has a completely different way of seeing and understanding things. And so, that is obviously suggesting that the way we see and understand things now is not a very particularly good one, right? And that's a fact. So we, what we need to awaken from is the delusion that we're caught in, that we've been caught in since we were born, and that has been reinforced by everything that we've ever learned, all of our interactions, the way the world works. It's all reinforcing the same illusion. And that deluded way of understanding things is what is at the root of all of our unhappiness and the unhappiness we create for others. So therefore, when we overcome that, you're liberated. So we call it liberation because you're liberated from that unhappiness. It's called an awakening because you overcome the illusion you've been trapped in. It's like waking up from a dream or a nightmare, more specifically. It's called enlightenment because when you cease to be trapped by delusion, then you're seeing and understanding things more as they actually are. And so it's wisdom, the wisdom that comes with that. And that wisdom is also associated with compassion. And so it changes not just how a person who has awakened experiences things, it also changes very profoundly how they behave and think and act in the world. At the root of it all is that we think things are one way, and they're not really that way at all. So what meditation does is it prepares the mind to be able to discover the way things really are, to realize the true nature of reality, and to see through the delusion that we've been trapped in. And that delusion Those things that we take for granted are the essence of that delusion. We believe that the world is more or less the way we perceive it to be. We believe that we are a separate, enduring self that we need to cherish and care for and protect. And we believe that our happiness and our suffering or unhappiness are dependent upon this self, the interaction of the self with the rest of the world that seems to be in a particular way. So that's the nature of the delusion. When you're training in meditation, you're changing through training the mind, you're changing the way the mind works, which allows you to have experiences that reveal the way things really are. And those are called insight experiences. So the objective of meditation is to change your mind in such a way that it is capable of recognizing the truth when that mind has experiences which reflect more the way things really are rather than the way they appear to be. And then that often happens in meditation. Those insight experiences often happen in meditation, but they don't always happen in meditation. Whether they happen in meditation or not, what you need to be able to do is to take those insight experiences and take what has been revealed in those isolated experiences and see the truth of that, to be able to apply that the rest of the time in everything else that you're experiencing. So each insight experience is a glimpse that reveals to some degree the way things really are rather than the way they appear to be. And further work usually needs to be done to incorporate those insights into a more complete understanding, basically to change your intuitive view of the world, your intuitive view of reality as it arises moment by moment. When I say intuitive, I mean coming from the deepest level of your mind, not an intellectual understanding. So your deluded perceptions arise from very deeply rooted misperceptions that you don't have immediate access to. You only have this very limited conscious experience. But whenever that conscious experience is of a nature that it reveals that things are different than the way you've always thought they were, and when you can take that understanding and apply it to, or see that it applies to, every other circumstance in your life, then at that deepest level of the mind, a change takes place, a transformation. So insight leads to this particular kind of change. The result is that the illusion begins to fall away. The illusion will fall away very strongly, very completely, for short periods of time. But you can repeat that experience, and you can consolidate that understanding. And so over time, you can become... you can come to experience the truth rather than the delusion that you have always experienced before. So, I don't know, sometimes I think people expect that meditation is going to be a kind of magic. And it actually can seem like it is when you start to have, when you have an inside experience which you understand and appreciate, that can seem like a magical event. But it's also the, it's a kind of magic that is only the result of making the effort and doing the work to train your mind so that your mind is capable of having that kind of experience and capable of seeing what's, of having that magical moment. So, yeah. I don't know. Why don't you help me by asking me some questions about how this works? Yes.
You know, so you're going along and you develop a certain amount of seeing things as they really are. Mm-hmm. But you're living in a society where most of the people don't see things as they really are.
Yes.
And how do you live in that?
A lot more easily, since you can see how things really are than everybody else.
Yeah, I know, but you still have got to interact with it. Committee meetings, traffic court, you still have to interact with it besides seeing the difference.
Yeah, that's the thing. You still have to interact with it, but you don't have to react to it. And that's what makes all the difference. When you don't have understanding, you have to interact, and most of your interaction is reaction. Reaction based on your conditioning and reaction to other people's reaction, and everybody's sort of at the mercy of what's happening, and nobody knows how to step outside of it very effectively. So the difference is that you still have to interact, you still have to go to traffic court or whatever the other examples you might think of, but you don't have to react. You can come from a place of seeing and understanding what's really going on. And that makes all the difference. Yeah.
Sometimes I have become aware that there's more space between a stimulus and a response, and that's really spiffy. But I also see that the response is still there. There's this, there's certainly all that you have said before about, you can choose not to act out. But I still see my old self. It's still right there. And the only thing that I'm doing is saying, oh yeah, there you are again. There's no new me. There's no, I'm still vulnerable to, I want that dog to shut up. There's wonderful space, and I can't give you a good concrete example of how that has freed me from knee-jerk response. But there's no, I still get peeved. I still feel that.
Yeah.
I just don't have to, I get to see myself being peeved. Oh, thank you very much. So, okay, we have more space between the stimulus and the response, but we're not all out of it yet. We're still in it. We just get to see that we're in it.
Well, see, there's a number of different levels that you are working on yourself as you train your mind, as you learn to be more and more mindful. You can think of it in terms of four different levels. And the fourth level is the one that involves awakening. And the first level is where you have the opportunity to moderate your responses to situation. And there's two more in between that. And the two in between that are where it starts to become magical. in terms of that's where you start to experience yourself changing. Yes, as you become more mindful, there is a space between the stimulus and the response, as you say. There is a space in which you can moderate what you say and do. And that's wonderful. That's going to improve things a lot. But if you've reached the point that that's happening to you very often, then you're going to start experiencing the next thing that happens as well. You see, if you are not only being mindful enough to moderate your behavior, you're probably being mindful enough to take in the fact that your reactions aren't really doing you that much good. You know, and it's wonderful that you moderate them, but you're taking in, just as you said, the fact that, yeah, but I still feel annoyed. And feeling annoyed, well, your mind will want to go to the place, and it's the damn dog that's barking. Mm-hmm. But if you're mindful, you say, well, actually, what's making me feel bad is my emotional reactions. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I'm just blaming it on the dog. So as you start to see that, then the effect that that's going to have is you're going to start reacting less strongly to those kinds of irritations. Because you are learning to understand that emotional reaction isn't changing the situation, it's just making you feel bad. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the second level of change that happens.
I guess the specific I wanted to ask is, you got it. When do I get to see the new choices of the moderation?
Well, see, the less strongly you react to any given situation, the more clearly that you can see things. Because it's been your emotional reactions that have clouded your perception before. And so as they begin to moderate, then you see more clearly, you see more options. You find it easier, you know, when you realize that if I hold on to these thoughts and these feelings, I'm going to put myself in a bad mood that lasts the rest of the day. And you find, well, actually, you know, I can just let go of that. I don't have to hold on to that. And you succeed in doing that. That's the kinds of possibilities that come. And each time you do that, it becomes easier to do that. And then actually in meditation itself, things will come up and you can do the same thing. You can greet those things with complete mindfulness and understanding and recognize their true relationship to who and what you are and your relative happiness or unhappiness. And in the same way, your mind ceases to generate whole categories of reactions because of this clarity that's being achieved. This happens in meditation, and that's the third level. All three of these levels that I've discussed so far are just dealing with your, what you might call, accumulated neurosis. Right? The habitual ways of reacting to things that you've required over the course of a lifetime. And everybody's different because everybody's had a different set of experiences and everybody's developed a different set of reactions to all these kinds of experiences. But through the combination of meditation and mindfulness, your own mind, without you having to do anything but be mindfully aware, your mind starts to sort these things out, and you change, and you see that you're changing. Excuse me. That I would compare to, if you go walking down a path and there's a cat-claw mesquite with his branches hanging across, The first step where you have enough mindfulness to moderate your reactions, that's like having enough mindfulness on your morning walk to dodge the mesquite branch rather than having it scratch your face or tear a hole in your shirt or something, right? But it's still there tomorrow. And so if you're not mindful tomorrow, you will scratch your face, right? Then that next level where through the practice of mindfulness, your reactions decrease until certain kinds of things just no longer push a button with you anymore. That's like you've trimmed off the branch that hangs over the path, right? The next level where in meditation you have some of these more deep-rooted things come up, that's like cutting off one of the trunks down at the root level, and all the branches go with it. When you cut off just one branch that's in the path, a new one's going to grow sooner or later, and of course there's all of the others. So you cut the trunk, then you've done a whole lot more. But that trunk will grow back, and new branches will grow, and eventually they'll be in your path. So awakening is all about digging up the root. But the same principle applies. And the principle is that you have an inappropriate way of perceiving situations and reacting to those situations, and it's inappropriate in the sense that it makes you unhappy rather than happy, and it causes you to do things that are harmful rather than helpful. So that's the commonality of it. So you have a conditioned way of reacting to a certain kind of circumstance, and as you recognize that you don't need to react that way, you can cease to react that way. And then as you realize that having that visceral emotional response that you do to that situation doesn't help you or anybody else, it just makes you miserable, you can let go of that. And as you let go of that repeatedly, you will cease to experience it. That emotional, not only will you not react verbally and physically in the same ways, but you'll no longer have the same emotional reaction either, which means that kind of circumstance won't bother you. So what we're talking about in terms of awakening is the root of all of these things. The root delusion that causes the root misperceptions that cause us to that actually lead us to suffer and actually lead us to do things that cause other people to suffer. The delusions are that our mind's model of the world is really the way it is. The world, reality really is the way our mind has constructed this model that it is. It is the delusion that we are this separate self. And the truth is that there is not the world of things out there that the mind projects, but rather there is process, and all that process is interconnected. And there's no separation between you and the rest of the process. But that's all just an illusion, a projection of your mind. The inappropriate reaction that you have from thinking that you're a separate being in a world of things, though, is that you think you have to have certain things to be happy and avoid certain other things to keep from suffering. And so you're driven by feelings of desire and aversion. And the feelings of desire and aversion make you do things that make more problems for you and more problems for everyone else. So it's just that same simple thing that we've talked about many times before. So the way that awakening is going to change all that is you're going to have experiences that allow you to see, first of all, you see that there really isn't a world of things, rather there's a world of independent processes. That's one kind of insight that you need to have. That there are no things. You need to understand that the thingness that you experience of both other things around you and the thing that you yourself think you are, that this is a projection of your mind. That your mind is doing this, And you catch your mind in the act of doing it. And when you catch your mind in the act of doing it, then you're not fooled by it anymore. And then this begins to translate more and more to an understanding of this self that you feel like you are, with all of its needs and its fears, you know, and its hopes and its desires and everything else. And you start to see that it too isn't a self-existent thing. It's a process. It's constantly changing. You're not the same person from one moment to the next. That it's just a constantly changing process. Constantly changing due to causes and conditions, because it's totally interconnected with everything else. And so you start to have insights into the way that clinging to the idea of the self as the way you had in the past is an illusion and is a part of the problem. And then you start to have experiences that reveal in very direct ways exactly how clinging to particular ideas and clinging to particular feelings of the way things are and who you are and things like that directly lead to your suffering, and also indirectly lead over time to all kinds of other suffering that ordinarily isn't very obvious, that we don't really see. So exactly the same process happens, that as you come to understand these things, then the way you run your mind processes experience changes, and you are no longer, you have more options, in the sense that you don't have to be overwhelmed by the conviction that you know how things are, because you know that you don't. You don't have to be overwhelmed by the feeling that you have to have this or you have to avoid that, because you realize that's not really what the source of your happiness or unhappiness is. In meditation, you'll have experience of happiness that has absolutely nothing to do with anything external to the mind. And that's a very revealing thing. That sort of paves the way for being able to let go of this attachment to self and external needs.
Yes? Yeah, I'm not sure if I can. Do you have a question? I'm sorry. I'm not sure if I can articulate it, but I'll give it a shot. So in the awakening process, the magical, as you were describing before we started going into dialogue, in your experience, is it possible that as you awaken and have perhaps a magical moment, if you will, even if it's a small gap, that you become aware that you were awakened the whole time, that you were mm-hmm. never not awakened, it's just that you didn't pay attention that you were awake. Does that make sense?
That might be a way that you that a person would choose to describe it, but it could be really confusing to somebody else.
Okay.
Because
it's been a little bit of my personal experience that I realized almost all the way back that I was like, oh,
you realize not awake. What you're realizing is that things never were the way you thought they were.
Mm.
That's what you're realizing.
Okay.
Because even after the experience, you'll slip back into believing that things are the way that you think they are. Mm. But if the experience has been potent enough, you won't forget. You'll still know, even though they appear to be a way that they're not, you'll know that they're not.
Mm. Okay.
So it's what I would compare it to, it's more like you wake up and you do slip back into the dream again. But sometimes when you slip back into the dream, you know it's a, you retain the awareness that it's a dream. Mm. That's the big difference. That's the big change. Yeah.
What makes an experience potent enough to really shift things?
Well, you know, what makes a particular experience that somebody has potent enough to change things is if that experience is addressing some crucial element of the way your mind has been constructing its reality up to that point. If it's addressing one of the crucial building blocks that your mind is creating the delusion out of, then it has that potency. It has that potential potency. I say potential because you also you have to be able to realize what it's telling you. You can disregard it. You can look, you know, you can look past it. You cannot see what it's telling you. So that's the other thing that's required. It has to be dealing with one of those crucial pieces of information, one of those crucial assumptions that your mind has been based on. And you have to see it and understand it clearly enough that your mind is forced to restructure the way that it interprets things based on this new information. Yeah.
I'm not sure I'll be able to say this in a way that will make any sense, but I'll try. Because it, in the business of meditation, my experience so far, initial experience in particular, is from waiting around for this insight to show up, it usually doesn't. In fact, it really never has, in that sense. I've yet to see a real insight come along. I have, however, begun to recognize the basic philosophy underlying a lot of all of this. The notion that we're transient beings, we're constantly in a state of change, makes a lot of sense to me. And so, two things have emerged. I tend now, when I'm meditating or trying to dwell on the thought that I really am a transient person in process of change, and I am interconnected with everyone else. And that actually has begun to make a difference to me. And I don't know if I'm doing it right, whether I'm skipping the crucial steps, whatever, but because it's making a difference to me, I perceive things with a bit more tolerance than I used to have, a bit more compassion than I used to have. So I'm curious to know whether or not you think I'm misguided or whether I'm doing something useful.
Sounds like you're perfectly on track. Mm-hmm. Yes, you say it's making changes, it's making improvement. Those insight experiences that I talked about, if you persevere with meditation, and especially if you have a bit of guidance, they're going to happen. They're going to happen and you're going to recognize them. And they're going, what they are is experiences that in a single moment really, really strongly reinforce, you know, hugely reinforce the same kind of thing that you are experiencing in a more gradual way through just holding the kinds of ideas and exploring and seeing that indeed that this is the way it is. So it's like an experience that I wish I could think of a good example right in the moment to illustrate it, but I think you can follow me. You can come to understand something, and then something will happen that really makes it super clear. And that's what an insight experience is going to be like for you. So you're doing the perfect kind of work to prepare the ground for that insight. So that when that kind of experience comes along, it's going to have maximal effect. You're going to be ready for it and receptive to it.
So maybe I will see one come along one of these days.
I think you will. But the thing is that in the meantime, it's already helping, though. It's already working. Right?
Yeah, it is.
Also, people can have a lot of little insights that make a huge difference. It doesn't have to be some, you know, really remarkable experience that all at once just, you know, changes your life forever. It can be a series of much smaller experiences that end up having exactly the same effect. Yes?
I feel like my question is dealing with the difference between living in the now and having a sense of a future. Mm-hmm. And it seems sometimes like with the practice there's a contradiction. Because there's a sense of something is going to happen in the future, like an awakening experience or a stream entry crossing, but it's in the future, so I'm training my mind for that. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, I know I'm living now. And it's like, am I mortgaging the now for the future to get there? So it's just like, okay, when I get my degree, I'll be really happy. When I get the car, things will change. When I get the stream entry. So it's like, when am I going to start living? How long? You know, like, but then at the same time, I can see changes progressively over years that I've meditated. But I feel like a part of me is just like not committing to the now, just holding off until that moment.
Well, in a sense, that is true. In the reality that your mind is confabulating, you're not awake yet, but you're going to be tomorrow.
Someday, over the rainbow.
And, and and that's really the way it is. What you don't want to do is to buy into that too strongly. It's easy to buy into that, and tomorrow never comes.
Right.
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 So, and it's an unfortunate thing that happens very, very easily. That people can live their whole life on a spiritual path for the sake of something that's going to happen someday. And in some extreme cases, it's something that's going to happen in the next life, or in 100 lifetimes from now, or in 10,000 lifetimes from now. You know, and that's not where you want to go. You realize, okay, the way my mind works, I don't feel enlightened yet, so it means it must be going to happen tomorrow, because it's not here now. And you recognize, okay, that's the way my mind works. But I just keep going ahead and doing the practice, you know, and then when you have the kind of insight that permanently transforms you, it's happening in that moment. It's not happening tomorrow. It's happening right now. And so that's what you're doing, is you're not preparing yourself for tomorrow that never comes. You're preparing yourself for the now that
it's here.
Yeah.
So is it a sense like you know, time being horizontal, or this, you know, like the axis can go this way or the axis can go this way. So if the axis is going this way, you're traveling through time. But if you're staying here, but you're going deeper, in a way you're not moving across time, you're just getting more into where you are.
Yeah.
Is that true?
And that's why sometimes it's helpful for people to think in terms of, well, you know, we're already awakened. There's nothing to do. I just have to realize that I'm already awakened. That can be a very helpful way of thinking. It can also be a very unhelpful way of thinking if you decide that feeling and acting in the unawakened way I do now is really awakened. You know, in which case it's
deceptive. Yeah.
So yeah, your mind definitely has this linear temporal aspect. That's just the way it is.
But in terms of just sort of the general everyday living my life, getting into the now is a good idea. I mean, you know, not spending a lot of time thinking about the future, mm-hmm. but being in the now is...
Well, that's really true, because the more truly present and fully conscious you are, the more awakened you are. That's another thing is that it's very easy to talk as though there's unawakened and then there's awakened, you know, and there's a dividing line that separates them. But, you know, it's really, we are really awakened, how to put it in a way. We are very much awakened even when we're not awake enough to know it. Right? We have moments of... We all of you, especially if you've been practicing for a while, you have those moments, those experiences of being fully present, being fully aware, and you know what this is, what this awakening is about. It's true, the phone rings and you lose it, or something happens, but then it'll happen again, you know, and so those are already woven into it. And what we're trying to get to that place where that's mostly where we are, rather than something that happens infrequently. Time's up.
Sound like my therapist.
We're just getting warmed up here. It feels like. You had a last question?
No, I have a question to lob into 2 weeks or whatever.
Okay.
On the question of seeing how it really is, I can't get out of my mind tonight the way, there's a whole subset of our culture that talks about anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
The 14 Times used to be some magazine that would deal with, you know, and they kind of wanted to make a huge conglomeration of everything weird that had ever been reported by anybody was all part of one big thing. And the phrase that captured it most pithily was, when you see something that doesn't really make sense, it's because the earth is dreaming. And I thought, okay, yeah, that's really poetic, but kind of even weirder than weird. And, you know, that, it captures it. I just really love to think that the earth is this entity that is like me and dreams and you know, I can't. So there's all this weirdness that happens, and there's this subculture that deals with we see Yetis because the UFO people left them here. Mm-hmm. You know, they just... And I want to get behind all the labeled weirdness and say, okay, it is true. Some people see things. Is that going further into delusion, or is that a consequence of stepping out of it? Some people see things.
Well, what your mind does, what everybody's mind is doing all the time, is creating a model for a reality based on whatever information you have. Of creating a model for reality, and you know, it's possible for somebody to create a model of reality that's quite different than yours, and it may involve UFOs and Yetis and all kinds of other things.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, everybody around you is creating a model of reality that's different than yours, but you don't notice so much until they start talking UFOs and Yetis.
Yeah, you're right. You can't tell until they open their mouths.
But the thing is, nobody's model of reality is reality.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how you change the model of reality that your mind is generating, it's still not going to be anything but a model of reality that your mind is generating. The only really meaningful way, it's ridiculous to take all these mind-generated realities and try to categorize them as more true or less true, because they're all equally untrue and equally true, right? It makes more sense that to just simply, some of them are more functional than others. Some of them are more useful than others. And the reason that most of us share the common reality we do is because it's more useful, not because it's more true. And if we go to a different culture, if you go from Western scientific culture to a shamanic culture, your reality isn't as useful as it used to be in that new situation. And it's not that your reality is any more or less true than the reality of the shamanic culture. It's just different. And in each situation, groups of people tend to develop consensual shared realities that work well in the context of that group and that situation. When somebody leaves a shamanic culture and goes into a technological society, their reality doesn't work that well anymore, so they have to make changes to it. But sometimes what they're able to do is they change part of it, but they retain certain parts of it, which actually gives them a certain advantage compared to people in the technological reality that don't have access to the same kinds of things that somebody with a shamanic reality does.
So you're saying that any given consensus reality is part of a process?
Well, that's absolutely true. I don't know that I was saying that, but I certainly agree with that. It is a process, and it is our nature that we all live in groups, and so we need to have a consensual reality. And look at the problems that happen when our realities are too different from each other. We have wars and struggles and all kinds of other problems. And it's not that anybody's reality is better than the others, but they're not working together, you know, and it creates all kinds of problems. It's a process. Generating reality is a process. And groups of people generate consensual realities that work good enough for them in the situation that they are, and that's why they have that reality. When the situation changes, when anything changes, then that reality may need to be tweaked in order to still be as useful as it was before. Or new information comes along, and that new information makes it possible to generate a different version of reality that makes things even better. You know, I mean, our Western technological scientific reality is not ultimate reality. It's just a story that we all make up together. But it has certain advantages. Most of us stay warmer during the winter because of it. Most of us have more ready availability of food because of it. That's the sense in which our consensual reality works. On the other hand, if we look at how it continues to unfold, it's not going to be too far from now. It's going to be pretty hard for us all to have enough to stay warm in the winter and have enough food to eat. So that's the problem with our particular consensual reality too. It's because it's our consensual reality is also based on the idea of limitless growth, and we have huge massive populations, and it's just unsustainable. We're all living in a reality that we didn't, you know, we live in each our own reality, and we play a major role in creating it. But we don't create it by ourselves. We, you know, our environment, our social environment creates it for us. We're just participants.
So are you tossing out any kind of data behind which the realities are more or less accurately based? Are you tossing all that out or not?
Any time that you try to evaluate realities in terms of more or less accurately based, more or less accurate, what standard, it depends on what standard you're using. We're nowhere near a place, and I don't think human beings are likely ever to be a place where we have access to the kind of standard that can make those kinds of evaluations of more or less accurate. But more or less useful, yes. Well, wait a minute, let me take that back. More or less, yeah. On one hand, I was thinking in terms of the way that we normally function and the way that societies normally generate their realities. But then what we were talking about earlier is seeing that this is only a creation of the mind. Now, to understand that whatever version of reality your mind is creating is only a version of reality created by your mind. That is definitely closer to the truth. That is definitely more accurate. To see that everything is interconnected and that the illusion of separate selfhood is the cause of the problem, that is more accurate. But these things are not so much telling you or giving you a way of constructing a reality that's closer to the way it is. It's more being less entrapped by believing in things the way they aren't. All these things are expressed in negatives, that we are not a separate self. Well, what are we then? It becomes really difficult to explain that. You can't explain that. Your mind, with its dualistic construct, cannot come up with a meaningful explanation that is very accurate for very long. There's all kinds of things that have been, all kinds of attempts have been made to do that, to intellectually construct what would be the opposite of a separate selfhood in a world of self-existing objects. And every intellectual attempt to do so, while it may in its first few phrases be reasonable, it soon enters a territory that makes it just as untrue as the way as where you started from. You know, typically where your mind wants to go is, I'm not a separate self, I'm just part of this cosmic soup. Well, that's not what it means either.
Julie, also, I'd like to submit that that's why things like poetry are so important and why there is even such a thing as poetry. Because it's always oblique.
Well, I think that I would agree with you that what poetry does is try to trigger the mind to a perception that is more true without trying to do so literally.
Right. Because so it puts you in that territory where your mind can...
So you get a feel for it. You get a sense for it. You know, it's like having... We can have a sense of all of our interconnectedness. But when we try to rationally, logically figure out what that means, that's when we get in trouble. Should probably call this to a close.